Good morning and happy Resurrection Day, everybody. And that's what we're talking about today. We're going to take a little break from Romans to dive into some concepts dealing with the proofs behind the resurrection of Christ. I think those are important to look at, and we'll talk about why here. Simply because Christianity completely and utterly rests upon the resurrection. It is the foundational point that has to be proven for the entire Bible to be viewed as true. In fact, the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1, verse 4, states that Jesus was declared the Son of God with power through the resurrection of from the dead. In the resurrection, Jesus Christ was proven to be who he said he was. So if there's one place that is going to be attacked, if there's one place that's going to be challenged, it's going to be, did Jesus really rise from the dead? Because you see, without the resurrection, Jesus' death was simply a tragedy. It was an unjust killing of an innocent man. That's all it was. There's nothing else that it was. Without the resurrection, the ascension and the glorification and our salvation never happened. And we're simply believing in a fairy tale. So the resurrection is the single most hotly debated event in the entire Bible. It is the one that gets attacked more than anything. Now, sure, there are people who deny that Jesus ever existed. It's kind of funny when people do this, because the evidence that Jesus existed and that he died and that he claimed, or that his followers claimed, that he resurrected, it's everywhere, not just in the Bible, but it's so many places outside the Bible that even people who don't believe in the Bible, scholars and skeptics, believe that Jesus lived and believe that he died at the hands of the Romans. They don't believe he was some fictitious person that somebody made up somewhere and just never existed. That argument seems to come back around every now and then, but it's not really one that can be proven or shown from sources. So as you can imagine, this event is the most studied and written about. And there's actually a lot of sources. If you ever want to dive in, there are books upon books upon books that are written that discuss the proofs behind the resurrection. There's one guy that I like quite a bit, and I've read a bit of his material. His name is Dr. Gary Habermas. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Habermas. He's pretty much spent his whole life on documenting the resurrection, and there's a lot of really good stuff. Matter of fact, I used some of his stuff to prepare for the message for today. So I would direct you to him. He's got, like I said, books upon books. Now, I'm going to give a little brief synopsis of some of the things that I found that he brought out, and we're going to discuss these. So he brings out 12 evidences. Now, there's more than this, but he brings out 12 evidences that are designed to be agreed upon between skeptics and Christians that set the bare minimal facts of the events surrounding Jesus' crucifixion. And out of these 12, he focuses on 5. Because, I mean, if there are 12 that pretty much everybody agrees on, he picks out 5 that really everyone agrees with. And he brings up the point that if you look at these, the only explanation that adequately explains all 5 logically is that Jesus Christ resurrected from the dead. So we're going to go over these today and discuss some of these aspects. So here are the 12. 1, Jesus died by crucifixion. That's so easily proven. So easily proven. Even Roman anti-Christian historians bring this up. 2, Jesus was buried. 3, his death caused the disciples to despair and lose hope, believing that his life was ended. Number four, and by the way, this will be online on our website this week. So if I'm going to be going a little bit fast, so if you don't have time to write all these down, that's okay. You can, it'll be listed on there. Number four, the tomb was empty a few days later. Even skeptics agree with this. Number five, the disciples had experiences that they believed were literal appearances by the risen Jesus. So even skeptics believe this, that they had experience, the disciples had experiences that they believed was the resurrected Jesus. So this created something that skeptics try to do to explain it. And this is actually how the Quran explains it. So the Quran teaches that Jesus didn't die on the cross, that he looked like he died on the cross. And then since he wasn't dead, he didn't resurrect. It's called the swoon theory, that he passed out because of blood loss. They thought he was dead. They buried him in the tomb, and then he recovered and somehow moved a big mass of stone and appeared to everybody. Now, you remember when Mary found Jesus by the tomb and she grabbed hold of him and Jesus said, "Stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father and to your Father." So an Islamic scholar by the name, I think his first name is Ahmed, but his last name is Didat. And he's a pretty well-known Muslim scholar. He was in a debate, I think, with Josh McDowell way back when about this. And he said, "Do you want to know why Jesus said, stop holding on to me, stop clinging to me? Because he had all these wounds and he was in pain." So let's think about this. The Romans were excellent at executing people, right? I mean, they knew how to execute people by crucifixion. Do you think a Roman is going to mistakenly think that Jesus was dead when he wasn't? When they pierced the side and two different types of fluid come out showing that he was dead. And when they went to break the legs of the people on the cross, they noticed that Jesus was absolutely dead and they just did this to check and to make sure and they found out that he was dead and then they broke the legs of the thieves next to him. And so let's think about this for a second. Jesus' body was wrapped, placed into a cold tomb, and somehow 3 days later, he managed to free himself from the wrappings, move a 2,000-pound stone, and walk out. It defies logical explanation. So the swoon theory is ridiculous. It's just silly. It's just silly. Number six, the disciples were transformed from doubters who were afraid to identify themselves with Jesus to bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. Now that really happened, didn't it? How many of the disciples were hanging around Jesus and witnessing the crucifixion? One, John. All the rest fled and were hiding. 50 days later, they're proclaiming in the midst of hundreds of thousands of people in front of the same authorities that crucified Jesus that he had resurrected from the dead. And we'll get into that a little bit more later. That doesn't make any sense unless he resurrected. Number seven, this message of the resurrection was the central preaching in the early church. Number eight, this message was proclaimed in Jerusalem where Jesus died and was buried shortly before. I mean, if he really didn't die and resurrect, why in the world would you be telling people 50 days after it happened? So a lot of people traveled from all over to come into Jerusalem. A lot of those people were probably there for the Passover, didn't go home because it takes months and weeks to get places, and would have stayed there and would have been there for the entire time. And yet here are these guys saying he resurrected from the dead. Sure would have been easy to prove otherwise. That's why they said that the disciples stole the body. But again, that doesn't make any sense. And we'll discuss why here in a moment. Number nine, the church was born in Jerusalem and grew rapidly. Number 10, this one's pretty interesting. Orthodox Jews who believed in Jesus switched from assembling on the Sabbath to assembling on Sunday. That's a big deal. I never thought about that one before until I read it. That's a big deal. That they moved from the Sabbath to the first day of the week. Why would they do that? It's interesting. To me, this is one of the most insurmountable evidences that exists, and we're going to spend a lot of our time talking about it. But I'm just letting it out there for right now. James, the half-brother of Jesus, converted to the faith when he was previously a skeptic. And we're going to go into detail as to why that is. And then, of course, you have the Apostle Paul, who was not only a skeptic, but a persecutor of the church and completely changed and went and started preaching the faith that he was trying to destroy. Now, the ones that are the most important, I think, that we need to take a look at, and again, we hit a little bit of it already, was the first one, Jesus died by crucifixion. And again, I did a message for family camp a couple years ago talking about extra biblical proofs of the Bible. And what we did is we went through and listed the different Roman historians and outside biblical sources that list as a historical fact that Jesus Christ died by crucifixion. And several of these were in the first century, and they were in Rome. So this lets us know that the message of this had already reached Rome very clearly and very ably. The fifth one that we mentioned, the disciples had experiences that they believed were the literal appearances of the risen Jesus. How can they have these without it actually taking place? Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15 for a second. When you look at what the scripture teaches, there's only two options. Number one, Jesus either really didn't die, and the swoon theory is accurate, and he somehow recovered enough to roll away a 2,000-pound stone without the guards that were placed out front knowing about it. Okay, that's one. That's one alternative. Or number two, that Jesus actually did resurrect from the dead. So maybe somebody had an hallucination. Maybe one person might have had an hallucination, or two people might have had a hallucination. But let's look at this for a second. Verse 3, 1 Corinthians 15. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died according to for our sins, according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day, according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now. Some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, and to all the apostles, and to last of all, to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. 500 people he appeared to at one time, many of whom were still walking around and could corroborate all of this. Now, these 500 people would have been people that were in Jerusalem during the day of Pentecost when the gospel was being preached. So not only did you have the apostles testifying mightily about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, you had these other 500 people going around saying, I saw him too. We were all in a group, all 500 of us, and he appeared. So someone could say, well, he didn't really die. Notice, think about this for a second. When the Jewish authorities decided to create a story, notice what they didn't create. That he wasn't really dead. That he just somehow passed out because of the pain and recovered a couple days later and managed to sneak out of the tomb. Do you know why the Jewish authorities didn't create such a story? Because nobody would believe it. Nobody survives crucifixion. Think about what Jesus went through. He was flogged. And if you've ever seen The Passion of the Christ, you probably have about a 75% understanding about what that was like. many people died from the flogging itself because of the serious amount of blood loss and the infection that would have set in. Think about all of the open wounds that Jesus would have had. And 6 hours, I mean, think about all the times that he probably fell into the dirt and the 6 hours he was on that cross. Think about the infection that would have racked his body over the next few days. In a probably a damp tomb that was carved into the face of the earth. You think he would have been like in a spa somewhere getting rejuvenated and like say, okay, I'm good to go. Now let me peel all these bandages off of me, this wrapping off of me. They wrapped him like a mummy. He couldn't move. His arms were down by his side. His legs were together. He couldn't move. How's he getting out of there? With the strength that he has. And so let's say he does get out of there. He doesn't have any infection, but his skin is literally hanging off of him because he's completely ripped open. He's lost tons of blood. And he's like, okay, I'm just going to, if I can provide enough leverage, I bet I can get this rock out. Because again, think about this rock for a second. It wasn't on a flat plane. The way they did it was on an incline. It was rolled up. Something was stuck underneath of it to keep it from rolling down. They would pull out whatever was rolling down or underneath it, and it would roll down into a channel. So he didn't just have to, you know, push it over. And again, it would have weighed a ton or two. Wouldn't have just been able to push it over. He would have had to roll it uphill from the inside without being able to grab an edge. That's why they never made this up. Because it's completely ridiculous. And then Jesus would have had to have done that completely silently so that he would have been able to sneak past the guards that were sleeping and standing right outside of there and make it to his disciples. It's ridiculous. That is why the Jews made up the claim that they stole the body. Because it's the only thing that made sense. So we're going to go with that one. Let's go ahead and deal with James. Let's go to John chapter 7. John chapter 7. Verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the feast of booths was near. Therefore his brother said to him, "Leave here and go into Judea so that your disciples also may see your works which you are doing." Now they were not saying that as supporters of Jesus. If you want to infer tone here, you should infer a large amount of sarcasm and mocking. And I'll tell you why. Keep going to verse 4. "For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers were believing in him. They weren't saying that because they believed in him. They were saying that because they didn't believe in him. James was one of his brothers. He was a half-brother. Okay, so that's a fact that needs to be understood. Yes, Jesus did have siblings. Mary was not a perpetual virgin. He had siblings, half-brothers and sisters. Let's head over to Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3, verse 20. It says, "And he came home, and the crowd gathered again, to such an extent that they could not even eat a meal. When his own people," that word for people is kinsmen or family, "when his own family heard of this, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying he has lost his senses." So the family's still hanging around Jesus, but they think he went nuts. And again, they didn't believe in him. They just thought he was a crazy guy because he was doing all these crazy things. So notice, even his brothers, even though they saw the things that he was doing, did not believe in him and they thought he was nuts. That was a hard heart. Now, remember earlier today we were talking about a prophet is not welcome in his own hometown. How much more so a prophet's not welcome in his own family? It's like, man, we grew up with Jesus. He wasn't that special. It was just kind of weird. That's how they viewed him. So notice, two notations in the gospel. They did not believe him. They thought he was nuts. Let's go to Acts chapter 1 now. Acts chapter 1. And I really love the way this stuff is written. It's not put together as a cohesive argument. Remember, you got different people writing these things. You got John who wrote John chapter 7. You got Mark who wrote Mark chapter 3. Now in Acts, we've got Luke. And we're going to go to another place that Paul wrote. Not the same author. This isn't written in a cohesive argument saying, see, here's a proof of the resurrection. It's laid out in separate places, but it makes it so that it's an airtight argument that cannot be ignored. That's the divine mind behind the scripture, but it also lets us know that God wasn't trying to present this to you in a cohesive single place so that you could recognize that this was absolutely true. This is not a coincidence. So Acts chapter 1, let's look at verse 12. So this is after Jesus ascended. Therefore, after Jesus resurrected. Verse 12. Then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey away. When they had entered the city, they went to the upper room where they were staying. That is Peter, John, James, Andrew, Philip, Thomas, Bartholomew, Matthew, James, the son of Alphaeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James. So the 11 apostles. Now look at verse 14. These all with one mind were continually devoting themselves to prayer along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. So up to the crucifixion, because his brothers weren't at the crucifixion. John got tasked with taking care of Mary, right? In the Gospels, Jesus is doing miracles and stuff. He's doing all kinds of stuff. And they think he's crazy, and they don't believe in him. And yet, after, all of a sudden, they start believing in him when everybody else disbelieves. Because the Messiah was not supposed to be crucified. He was not supposed to die. That was one of the main arguments in the Gospels. We know that the Messiah or the Christ remains forever. They thought they were proving that Jesus wasn't the Messiah. So if anything, the crucifixion should have emphasized their disbelief and proven that they were right. So what in the world happened? Now you could infer, well, Jesus must have risen from the dead. But you know what? You don't have to infer anything. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15 again. Verse 6 says, after that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to who? Who? James. Then to all the apostles. And last of all, someone untimely born, he appeared to me also. That's James, the brother of Jesus. He was simply known in the scripture as James, and you might read about him a lot in the book of Acts. Because he is the man in Jerusalem. He is the elder, one of the elders in Jerusalem. In Acts chapter 15, he's the James that gives the final decision. He also wrote the book of James. That is the half-brother of Jesus. Do you want to know what happened from the time that he disbelieved in the Gospels to the time Acts chapter 1:14, after Jesus ascends into heaven, what changed with him that he became a believer? He saw the resurrected Christ. And he believed it so much that he either was stoned to death by the Pharisees in the 60s AD, or there's two different accounts, or he was taken up to the pinnacle of the temple, thrown off, survived the fall, and was bludgeoned to death by clubs. All due to the fact that he would not relent on the preaching that his half-brother, Jesus Christ, died, was buried, was resurrected, and ascended to the right hand of the Father. To me, this is one of the most powerful, amazing concepts of the resurrection. That you take someone who was such a doubter, and then ended up dying for his faith. And we'll get to the rest of the apostles here in a moment. One of the other things I want to mention is something called the Nazareth inscription. Has anybody heard of that one before? The Nazareth inscription. So it dates back to the reign of Claudius, sometime between 41 and 54 AD. It's one of the earliest inscriptions that they find about this kind of stuff. I'm going to read it for you. Tell me if you notice a theme. Edict of Caesar. It is my decision concerning graves and tombs. Whoever has made them for the religious observances of parents or of children or household members, that these remain undisturbed forever. Oh, and so this was found in Nazareth, by the way. Who's from Nazareth? Just checking. But if anyone legally charges that another person has destroyed or has in any manner extracted those who have been buried or has moved with wicked intent those who have been buried to other places, committing a crime against them, or has moved a sepulcher sealing stone, against such person I order that a judicial tribunal be created. Just as is done concerning the gods and human religious observances, even more so will it be obligatory to treat with honor those who have been entombed. You are absolutely not allowed, or not to allow anyone to move those who have been entombed. But if someone does, I wish that violator to suffer capital punishment under the title of a tomb breaker. 41 AD. Word had already gotten back to Caesar that the body of Jesus was stolen. And therefore, in a whole new movement had started that was causing conflict and disrupting one of the provinces and creating challenges for the Roman government. That's my interpretation. But what's not my interpretation is that he just made it a capital offense for anyone to take a body and to break the seal on the stone that was in front of the grave. Because again, that was the story that was told. So, Matthew 28:13, they told to tell people that the body of Jesus had been stolen. So what this corroborates for us was that this was a thing that was going around during the time right after the death of Jesus, when this story would have been being manifested and told to everybody around. And so the question somebody might ask is, well, actually, doesn't this prove that the body of Jesus was stolen? No, not at all. This proves that this was the explanation that the Jews were given as to why Christianity was doing the things it was doing. And so I've heard people or read people try to refute this and say, well, this is simply an edict against grave robbing. Grave robbers don't take bodies. Grave robbers take stuff that's in the tombs. This is something completely different. Completely different. So, again, we've already discussed the whole concept of, was the body of Jesus stolen? But that was, and it wasn't, because it doesn't answer to what we're going to talk about next. It definitely doesn't answer what James dealt with. But the other point is this, it lets us know that that was the narrative that was being that was around, and it was specifically written to the folks in Nazareth, where Jesus was from. I just find it very interesting. The other aspect as to why the body of Jesus wasn't stolen goes back to the concept that the disciples were transformed from doubters who were afraid to identify with themselves to those who were bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. This cannot be underestimated as well. I'm going to just read you a few things. A lot of this is based on tradition, but it's tradition that's early on documented in church history. Peter, crucified upside down in Rome during the reign of Emperor Nero, as he reportedly did not consider himself worthy to be crucified in the same manner of Jesus. Now, if you've ever hung upside down for a while, you know that that is an uncomfortable position to be in. One of the things that they would do for people like that so they wouldn't pass out is they'd make a little cut behind the ear so that they could bleed off some of the pressure. At least that's what I've read. I don't know how accurate that is. You medical folks would know better than I. Andrew was crucified on an X-shaped cross known as a saltire in Patras, Greece, during the reign of Nero. James, the son of Zebedee, was, and this is in Acts chapter 12, was beheaded in Jerusalem by order of King Herod Agrippa. John the apostle was tortured and died of natural causes in Ephesus. Only apostle that died of natural causes, but he was tortured. Philip the apostle, he was martyred, crucified. Some suggest he was stoned to death. Bartholomew is, and I've mentioned this before, his statues typically in remembrance of him show him around his shoulders carrying a shawl or something along those lines. Well, it's not a shawl. It's a skin. He was flayed alive. Skinned. Alive. For the gospel. Matthew. Tradition suggests that he was stabbed to death or killed with a sword or spear. I guess that's stabbed to death too, isn't it? Doubting Thomas. I won't believe unless I touch him. I don't think he would have touched a corpse and done this. He was stabbed with a spear in India. What makes somebody go to India? For a stolen body? And then get run through with a spear? James, son of Alphaeus. He was either stoned to death or beaten with a club. Thaddeus. Tradition suggests that he was, or recollects that he was crucified. Simon the Zealot. Oh, Simon the Zealot. He was hung upside down with his legs spread and sawn in half. Hardcore torture, right? Matthias. He was martyred, but they don't really know how he died. Here's my question. If you perpetrated a heist of a body and you knew it was a lie, you gonna keep doing that? Let's say they were letting this thing ride a little bit. Peter and John get arrested, they get threatened, get released. Okay. Acts chapter 4, no problem. Haven't suffered physical. Let's keep this going. We got money coming in. Let's keep going. Then all the apostles get arrested and they get flogged. Well, guys, is the juice worth the squeeze on this one? You know, we all just got flogged. But man, think about the power we have. I mean, if we stop now, everything's lost. They're like, okay, well, you know what? No worse for wear. We'll heal up. Let's keep pushing through. Yeah, we know it's a lie, but let's keep pushing through. I mean, we got a good thing going here. Then James, son of Zebedee. Then he gets arrested and gets his head lopped off. Then Peter gets arrested, and he's about to get his head lopped off. You going to keep going after that? Absolutely not. not for a lie. Every single one of those guys persevered to their death and went all over the place suffering for the gospel. You're not going to do that for a lie. No way, shape, or form. By every historical evidence that you want to have, by whatever level you want to judge this by, the only logical solution for just those couple of things, not to mention all the other stuff that happened as a result of this, not to mention the fact that there was this huge movement that was created that made it all the way to Rome within about 30 years. The only logical explanation is that Jesus Christ resurrected from the dead. Nobody's going to do what they did if they were involved in a lie, if they were involved in the heist of a body. So, brethren, what I just want to encourage you with today is that Christianity has such a burden of proof that you can easily, intellectually, grab right a hold of it and take it to your grave. You can base your entire life off of it and never be intellectually inferior. You can stand with anyone and discuss this and never be ashamed of the gospel, because we know, based upon the historical evidence that's there, biblical and extra-biblical, that's true.